section that we'd like to pursue are issues that are specific to the IRB review process. Dave, you're going to lead us through that.
Okay. So we're interested in the IRB external review process, partly to find out what happened and how it happened, but also recognizing that this perhaps probably will, could go on other places as issues come up. So we're trying to learn how the process went, where it didn't fulfill its goals, and what we can take the homeless messages. So I guess this review was partly triggered at the request of NCI, or maybe you can elaborate on that at some point. But first question is, so like, who was coordinating this process and sort of trying to guide it and seeing to make, and we can just start and we'll move on through some series of questions.
So maybe I can just set up a little bit of the background and how it evolved. So soon after the Annals and Statistics paper came out, Kim Lyerly, in his role as Cancer Center Director, was contacted by Jeff Abrams and Lisa McShane at CTEP with concerns primarily around the notion that those findings had been used as the underpinning for clinical trials, and they were concerned about patient safety. So Kim contacted me in my role as vice dean for research, and I had been vice dean for research for about 3 weeks at that point. And I spoke to Kim about it, and we then got in contact directly with the NCI. The reason the NCI had spoken to Kim, if I'm remembering correctly, is that they had informed him that they were going to contact our IRB about the concerns. So it was sort of a heads up. And at that time, I also circled to Dr. Nevins, and we'll get back to that about the science. But in any event, we spoke to the folks at NCI, and they expressed their concerns, and we felt that the best way to address those concerns was to do some sort of external review process, And at that point, sometime in the intervening weeks, they did contact the IRB directly, so everyone was on the same page. And we wanted to run an external review, but we wanted to have two criteria met. One was we wanted the review external reviewers selected in some sort of unbiased fashion, so we actually selected the reviewers in consultation with the NCI. In fact, Dr. McShane was very helpful in suggesting a list of possible people with the correct expertise, so that was one thing. The other thing is a decision was made to run it as a peer-reviewed IRB process so that the IRB would actually conduct the review. And part of the thinking behind this had to do with the fact that we wanted the reviewers to be able to say, this is great or this is terrible, without any sort of undue pressure. So a lot has been made, I think, in the press of the keeping the reviewers confidential, but the intent at the time was really to protect the unbiased nature of the process.
So what exactly did you charge them to do? In other words, what was their assignment when you identified them and asked them to participate?
So, again, all of the communications with the reviewers was done by the IRB. So I should be clear that when you say you
yeah.
it really was through the IRB, but we did all discuss what the nature of the questions should be.
Could you lead us through what the questions were?
Yes.
Because I think that got asked, but I don't know that we ever saw the
yes.
invitation
and in fact,
document to the reviewers.
You know, I don't have the verbatim
about
one in front
names.
Of me, but
that's okay.
The sense of it was the questions that you've probably seen in the public space, and that really was the sense of it. We were really driven by the patient safety concern at the time, and actually I'll circle back to this, but it wasn't really until much later that I understood that part of Dr. McShane's concern was an inability to reproduce the original findings in the papers. We were really concerned about whether the methodologies, as they were put forward, formed a firm basis for the clinical trials. And that becomes important, I think, as we talk through some of the details. But the questions we posed to the reviewers were twofold. One was we wanted to know whether the issues, as they were put forth in the Annals of Statistics papers, could be adequately addressed. In other words, were Drs. Nevins and Potty able to address those concerns in a way that the reviewers found credible in dealing with them? The second question was, were the predictors likely to perform in the clinical trials as hoped? In other words, was it, they couldn't say it would definitely work, but they wanted to know if it was plausible and credible that such predictors would perform. And Mike may want to make an additional comment. Is that?
We'll have to go pull it exactly, but it wasn't whether they were likely to perform as much as were they still valid to be tried in this manner,
right,
in a clinical trial. Because at that time, this then was reflecting back in the clinical enterprise, which is why I had the interest. These were issues that were being portrayed and going on in the peer review literature that purported to be an academic debate. The number of tools that we have at that point are a little limited. We're not typically, as a university, in the position to adjudicate someone's science or certainly insert ourselves in an academic debate. We have research misconduct, but we had no one raising that as a term and with people well aware of what that means, what that terminology is. Nonetheless, we were left with clinical trials that were ongoing and needed to both make sure that the patients in the trials should or should not continue an assigned therapy, and then we needed someone to adjudicate this debate in an informed, learned way and help us understand whether or not these issues, these critiques had been addressed and were addressable, and whether the predictors were appropriate to continue in the clinical trials. And that's where we felt as though it was important to address those two questions, to get someone outside. It was a peer review action, and so Dr. John Harrelson, not John Folletta, but John Harrelson, who was the chair of the IRB acting on Dr. Folletta's behalf, had the interactions from the NCI. There was a handoff of the outside reviewers to Dr. Harrelson, who then formulated a charge, talked to them about a likely timing to get a report back, and then eventually received a report back.
There's too many mics on.
Mike, you said that, we're just the university and we have a hard time adjudicating something like this. And I can understand this. This is complicated stuff. It takes a lot of...
I wouldn't say we had a hard time. It's not our normally for us
to adjudicate
someone's science.
And it's not normal.
Yeah.
My question is, and this is a general thing, and it's not just related to Duke, but it's just related to universities and science in general. When there really was a scientific controversy here and Mother Nature works one way or not, and in the end we found out that it worked very different than things initially got concluded. Looking back, can you say something about the lessons that you learned and what this means going forward? Are there some things where we're just a university or we don't normally do this or we don't have the resources, and there ought to be some separate structure even to do this? I mean, this committee's looking at how, when a university's stuck with this problem, because ORI doesn't do it, there's nobody else that does it. Right now, it's the university that's supposed to. Do you have lessons and recommendations looking about how you would have done it different or how other, new structures need to be invented, or what's the issues and lessons here?
I actually would even add to that further. When we stopped the trials the second time for the reasons that we can discuss, part of the reason we're all here today was a number of us sitting around saying, okay, we have an academic debate that's also taking an additional turn in that there are issues of data integrity. Now, that means different things to different people. Who is an unimpeachable now third party that is well-positioned to do that review? And at that point, having already tried in cooperation with CTEP at NCI to find an unimpeachable third party who didn't turn out so well, we were left with trying to identify an unimpeachable third party, and we are here today because our thoughts turn to a lack of national bodies other than the IOM to help in this space.
Sally?
So, I think you may be asking a more granular question, which is, at the time we did think it was a methodological and scientific interchange. And I think probably one of the chief lessons learned is, there's a balance between trusting investigators that have a very long track record with an institution and also thinking about what is necessary to ensure an adequate review. And I think none of us, and I don't think the IRB, really thought about issues of data provenance at the time and thought about ensuring that really the raw data was examined. At the time, we wanted to know whether the methodology was robust and whether a predictor would work. But we did not, we didn't have questions about data provenance and integrity, which in retrospect was not wise.
At the time you collectively launched this external review, did you, at that point, had you, for example, met with NCI, Lisa and Jeff in particular, to get what they knew at that point in time, or did you take it more of a judge?
Right, so it was only later in the process that we met with Lisa and Jeff. We did not meet with them ahead of the initial review.
And the reviewers themselves did not have the opportunity to meet with them?
So, you know, it's interesting because the reviewers were given unfettered, we believed unfettered access to the materials, and they were certainly free to contact whomever they wanted, but we did not direct them, or the IRB did not direct them to talk to Dr. McShane or, for that matter, to talk to Dr. Baggerly. They were certainly free to do so.
So one of the reasons, again, I'm interested, we are interested in sort of a general way because, unfortunately, your experience probably isn't unique.
No.
So when someone's asked to do this, the question is, well, what's the scope, what resources, what time frame? Because in my earlier life, I went through a similar process. And as we learned from Lisa, you know, it's a 2 to 3 to 4 month process to get
yes.
to the bottom of things. So this committee probably, you didn't frame it with that magnitude, I'm guessing.
Right. So, you know, it's interesting because I really only came to understand this later when we went to NCI and Lisa started talking about the inability to exactly reproduce the figures using the BINREG code. At the time, the R code, which Bill can speak more to, that he had worked with as the basis of the trials is what we were concerned with because we really wanted to know if trials had been operating properly. Had anybody charged the reviewers at that point to exactly reproduce the figures that were present in the papers, the outcome would have been different.
Sally, again, can you say more about what the lessons are going forward? I'm hearing you say, I came up to speed after talking with Lisa McShane and so forth, and
right.
you're just the dean, and you're a normal human being, and you're a biologist, and you can't be expected to understand all this stuff. And I'm trying to think about how people in your position
right.
should approach this, because there's lots of specialized knowledge lying around. Does this mean you talk to Lisa McShane, you show Lisa McShane the questions and say, Lisa, do you think this charge is right, or even Baggerly?
Right.
You don't have to take his word for it, but how do you get the expertise to figure out how to manage something like this?
Don't lose that question. But just to make sure I understand before we leave this, mm-hmm. So essentially what I'm understanding you say is that when you configured this, or the IRB configured
yes.
this committee, there wasn't the recognition that part of this process was ensuring that the data are traceable to their origins.
Exactly.
And specifically that issues of data provenance and integrity are part of what had to be validated. That wasn't...
That's exactly right. And part of it is because we... you know, as I said, there was the assumption that everyone was dealing in good faith and was trying to really get to the bottom of this and to the truth. So our assumption was that anything that the reviewers would find necessary would be in front of them, and they were not specifically charged with looking at data provenance.
Can we get back to the larger question?
Yeah,
I've got a question about the provenance, too. But the one that I asked before that I forgot.
Yeah, no, I forgot.
You're dealing with complicated
oh, yes.
science.
So,
what, you know, how do universities get this expertise, or does it need to be a separate group, or the resources
right.
that Dave... I mean, this is a real problem, and you guys
That's
are the
right.
adjudicators, you guys meaning all of us,
right.
the universities, what do you
right.
do?
So this is a big part of this TMQF effort that we're talking about, which is when you translate something, or when there are questions, what kind of review... can you get? Now, in retrospect, it was a problem that we've been talking about all along in communication. For example, I had assumed, for instance, that Dr. Barry was a much more integral part of transferring the material to the reviewers than he was. We assumed that more eyes had been on some of this information than there had been. So I think that having very explicit conversations about who was involved in such a review, thinking about what expertise might have to be brought to bear. And, you know, in retrospect, Although we went into a doing it confidentially for good reasons, I think had it been an open public review, things would have been a little bit different too, because the reviewers could have then had an open dialogue with the community.
Let me just add a couple of things. I think we're all coming to the conclusion in clinical trials that quality by design is far superior to retrospective auditing. In other industries, I figured this out a long time ago, and I think science is finally beginning to evolve to that. So to me, the key thing here is the open kimono when questions are raised. If they had had to show their wares,
can we strike this from the records?
there were promises about putting things out for public display that were not kept.
There were promises, but also the reviewers at the end of their report, the redacted
suggested
report,
it, yes,
said, we can't reproduce what you did, and it would be nice if you showed it to the world. Doesn't that sort of make the antennas vibrate and stuff like that?
And the investigators had said that they had just submitted a paper for peer review that laid out the
methodology. I think they said they were planning to do that. Did they say they'd submitted it?
They did, actually.
Did you see it?
I did not see the paper.
It was not that paper was not submitted at that point. I'm the first author on this manuscript.
Okay, then you know.
It got submitted in February 2002.
But there is a broader lesson here. Yeah. You asked about, one of the broader lessons goes to our discussion this morning, whereby not just the open kimono at the time, but also standard formats, the standard format for portraying the data, rather than multiple different formats, becomes important to bringing in outside expertise that can quickly review and understand the merits of it.
Can you say something, too, about the decision after Baggerly sent the material to you guys in November, I think, that ended up being, it was an open letter basically saying here's how the data still aren't right, and I think that decision didn't get forwarded to the committee, and as I recall, vaguely from the cancer letter, this went to the highest levels, although it didn't spell out any names. But, I mean, it sounded like a lot of thought went into this. Could you sort of lead us through that decision, and then what lessons there may be for you and others from that?
Well, the overwhelming lesson I can start with is that all materials should be brought to bear in these situations. I can tell you what happened at the time was that the email was sent to me. I forwarded it immediately to the IRB to enter into their peer review system. John Harrelson of the IRB, I believe, with good intent, knew that Joan Evans and Anil Patti at the time were preparing all the material for the external review. And so he sent it to them and said, please take this into account as well and address these comments so that when the external reviewers see it, they'll see your response. And Dr. Nevins had a very negative reaction. Basically, he said that it would bias the review. Now, this discussion that followed, it did involve myself, Dr. Zhao, Cuff, others. And again, I think that the notion was that the reviewers would have unfettered access to everything, that the data would speak for themselves. And maybe this was partially coming from a basic science background where I really firmly believe that data should speak for themselves. And so the decision was made that if the reviewers really truly had unfettered access, they would discover any issues
unfettered
without bias
access to what?
To everything.
But you said they would have to ask for it. They could try to get it or talk with Lisa McShane.
They would have to dream of what it was they should ask
right,
for.
Right, so that was a lesion in retrospect, which is that what the IRB and indeed we assumed was being done was not how the reviewers construed the questions that we asked. So I think there's a lesson there that if you want a particular thing done in a certain way or in an exact, you're asking an exact question, the questions have to be crafted very precisely.
And who crafted the questions? Was it? And again, this is a
no. I understand.
Lessons
it was,
from that.
No, it was. It was.
News.
You know, it was a group of us. I mean,
in the end, you know, the IRB had to sign off on it.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. And then the IRB, John Harrelson, forwarded a letter, and he formulated the final response. But he had input from a broad group. In terms of that email, you know, we were becoming aware at that point that there had been a legion of emails between Dr. Baggerly, Dr. Coombs, and Dr. Nevins. So we also made a bad management decision in not recognizing that that might be something different. Dr. Nevins was telling us it was the same. We felt as though they were going to have wide-ranging access and we probably could have provided more to the reviewers.
Just to finish up on this issue is, it's a good illustration of what leads some of us to worry, at least the perception of was there adequate independence. Because our understanding of the specifics was that on November 9, 2009, you'd received this supplementary information mm-hmm. from Dr. Baggerly, mm-hmm. and then you did specifically act on turning that over to Dr. Harrelson.
Yes.
And specifically then sent an email to Dr. Baggerly assuring him that you had done so and that this would be then taken mm-hmm. to the reviewers. The issue of concern is it appears, from our understanding, that Dr. Harrelson then contacted Drs. Potty and Nevin and enabled them, at least, mm-hmm. to convince him not to share this information.
Exactly.
Which seems to be problematic if this is if we want an independent review process to review the work that Nevins and Potty were doing, that they were empowered here to intervene and convince this Dr. Harrelson to not forward the information.
Right. You know, recall, I think the mindset at the time, and, you know, as someone said, hindsight is 20/20, I think it was really believed at the time that everybody, including Drs. Nevins and Potty, wanted to get to the root of the scientific problem. So, you know, in retrospect, you can overlay all sorts of motivations, but it really was not in anybody's mind at the time that anybody wanted anything except an unbiased evaluation of the true facts of the case.
But the fact that the IRB was in charge mm-hmm. seems to have been motivated by your initial concern about patient safety.
Yes.
If it wasn't patient safety driving your concern, a truly unbiased external review wouldn't have involved the IRB at all.
That's correct. And although I have to say that having it under a peer review protection, as I said, was also had the implications of all that goes with peer review. In other words, that people can come to whatever conclusions they come to just based on the facts rather than having to worry about any outside appearances or impressions. And I think that criteria is also met by being under the umbrella of IRB peer review.
Did this aura of confidentiality or anonymity of this committee sort of inhibit them from approaching Baggerly themselves and or Lisa? I mean, because then they would have disclosed who they were.
Right. So it should not have.
The NCI knew, because
NCI issued the invitations.
Okay, all right.
So what was that invitation promised confidentiality?
It was really a community issue. So if you, and you know, again, in hindsight, this was obviously not the right way to go, but if you're asked to review something and you really think there are a lot of problems and you want to be incredibly explicit about that, you might not want, or let's put it the other way, actually. Let's say they had come out and said, all the concerns of Baggerly and Coombs are nonsense. Everything is fine. We didn't want them to feel that they had to be drawn into a protracted public debate. We wanted them to really just be able to look at things, give us an honest evaluation without having to put their own professional foot into the argument. It's, you know, in retrospect, obviously, if they had to put their own professional foot into the argument, it probably would have changed the nature of the inquiry. But unfortunately, at the time, we didn't realize that.
In retrospect, too, I remember some biostatistician said in the cancer letter, I would have preferred to have been named. They said that and said if the charge had looked as constrained as it was, nobody knew exactly mm-hmm. what the charge was. Mm-hmm. At least they said in the cancer letter, they would have been concerned about that. Can I ask one other question about the events?
Can I just make one comment about that? Which is the reviewers, the way this was set up, and again in later conversation after all of this came out, you know, they were not bound at that point. They could have volunteered to.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's.
But by then they'd done a report that they thought was going to be under confidentiality.
Yes.
Can I ask another issue about something that happened in November and that relates to the handling of the committee? There was the Lancet Oncology paper and the issue of blinding surfaced in November. And what happened was that Bonifoy and DiLorenzi mm-hmm. and I forget whoever else basically wrote a letter to the cancer letter, saying mm-hmm. The data were never blinded. And that was a pretty critical thing for external validation that the Nevins group had claimed both in talks and also in print. Mm-hmm. And I sort of wonder how that hit your guys' radar when that happened. Was this important, this is academic disagreement, and he said, she said, where did that fit on your guys' radar screen?
Right, and I'll comment, and then perhaps Mike would like to comment. This, again, goes back to an issue that I think this committee has to think about, which is, as scientists, we like to think that years and years and years of credible work gives us a certain amount of credibility. And so, you know, our response was to go to the investigators and say, look, there's been this accusation. What's your response? And the response,
accusation of not blinded.
Yes, exactly. And the response was, it was blinded.
Now, in the letter, though,
that's, that's really not a matter of opinion.
It's also not credible.
Very quickly, to check what is true.
Sally, in the cancer letter that DiLorenzi sent, the code, which was in the cancer letter, said, here's what we sent to Duke. It wasn't data and then an envelope and you guys open it later, which it could have been.
So Dr. Nevins had said on October 2nd in the cancer letter, he was quoted at least, that the analyses were conducted blinded to outcome. DiLorenzi was then quoted 3 weeks later in the cancer letter, indicating that the responder non-responder status was embedded in the file, resulting in unblinding of the outcome.
That was it was never blinded. It was responder number one, non-responder number two. That's how the data got received. So it's not arguable. This is the data were unblinded from the get-go. It's not a difference of opinion. The reality underlying can't be disputed.
I think Sally's been clear that that there was too much allowance for the credibility of reputation to take precedence over investigation, and this is in a setting where, you know, what triggers a university to investigate a prominent person, you know. In my view, and I think all of us talking about it, there were this whole series of, you know, I said early on, there was a whole series of signals out there. The response, you know, should have been more vigorous. And this is just one other example. It is not hard to figure out whether a study is actually blinded. And
yeah.
But that I can also assure you, having talked to 162 co-authors on papers, that there are many who have no idea what blinding even means.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you guys, the lessons learned, and that's actually what Rob just got to, is in the sort of for future deans or vice deans, when do you pull the trigger on bringing in the else? You know, because if we did that every time, you would run, you'd get exhausted because there's always something, right? So, based on what you've learned, how do you decide when you need to call? This case, it was requested by NCI, who had other inside information or insight rather. But how do you do that, and what machinery do you put at their disposal to investigate? Because I said, you're going to get really to the bottom. It's a lot of work.
Yes.
Can I give that a shot first?
Please.
I've been thinking about this a lot. I'm frequently involved in investigating, as I say, sites and multi-center trials where there are problems and issues. I mean, to me, having this group that we now have that meets once a week is absolutely critical, because in the end, it's going to be a matter of judgment as to when a threshold is exceeded. And that committee needs to call in content expertise well before there's a formal investigation. You know, in this case, if somebody who was a bioinformaticist or a statistician well-versed in clinical trials had read that, talked to Baggerly and Coombs, I think the outcome would have been different. In addition to that, I think the other elements that we put into the TMQF principles and implementation would be important. For example, you would find out, is this unit a place which has got an open approach to inquiry? I can tell you we've got two other cases right now where concerns have been raised, and the response is entirely different. The data are available in their raw form, and we're inviting the people that are critiquing to come to the institution and have a public discussion over who's right. And I think one of the lesions here, which again goes back to the giving leeway to the person with a lot of street cred in the institution, is the failure to follow up on promises to do these things, like make the data available or submit a publication and things like that. It just didn't happen. And, you know, it would have been good to have seen. Those are signals that we actually need to pull the trigger. But I think this group that meets weekly is probably going to be where the key decisions are made. It includes seven or so people and issues that are raised that are in this area. You know, again, if it's absolute scientific misconduct being alleged, that goes down a pathway which is very clear. If it's we don't agree with the statistical test that was chosen, that's a different issue. The stuff that's in the middle is going to be more frequent, and I think it requires judgment and more than a few people looking at it.
Just want to return to what we were saying here, just in terms of preponderance of evidence here and at least perceptions that can emerge from it. So it's already been indicated that there were areas that weren't recognized, the issue of the need to trace to source data, mm-hmm. the issue about providence and integrity. Mm-hmm. There was the issue that when you did turn over information from Dr. Baggerly to Dr. Harrelson, that Dr. Nevins and Potty were able to be in the middle of that, yes. between that getting connected. The issue that we were just talking about DiLorenzi's revelation on October 23rd, that such an important trial, this validation trial was such an important trial, mm-hmm. and yet the integrity of this could be challenged based on the revelation that, contrary to what had been said on October 2nd, that these data were, in fact, potentially unblinded. We assume something, but I don't know if it's true. I'm assuming this actually, these insights didn't also get conveyed to the IRB review group. Is that true or not?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, those were public, as you said, those were publicly available pieces of information in the cancer letter, et cetera.
Right.
I don't
Which
know
they
if
conceivably
they were,
could have yeah. seen, but we couldn't assume that they would see them.
I don't know the answer to that.
I'm not fully aware, and I'm not sure that John Folletta is able to answer that today, what that package of information that John Harrelson, the chair of the IRB, conveyed to the outside reviewers, as well as the access that was provided, obviously perhaps problematic by the investigators themselves.
So many things were happening at similar times, and this exchange in the cancer letter was emerging at the time that this committee was being charged, and there would have been time for this to have come mm-hmm. to light and to be brought to them. So at least what you're saying is, to your knowledge, there wasn't specific actions that you know about to ensure that the IRB statistical reviewers were informed about this exchange.
Not that we know
about. And that this could, therefore,
sure.
lead to much more uncertainty about the validity of the Bonifoy confirmatory trial,
right?
Which might have been something that could influence reviewers to say, well, if there are irregularities in how these predictors are developed, if they're still accurately predicting,
right.
that leads additional credibility.
It's interesting, though, because the reviewers were bioinformaticists, and they, again, the narrow focus and the nature of the reviewers, it's hard to know what their sort of experience with clinical trials, how they would have dealt with that information. We don't know.
The concern is that there are multiple sources here of information that
yes.
now we look back to say would have been very informative and could
Absolutely.
Significantly enlighten and alter the perspectives of these reviewers.
Right. So the conclusion is that all information should be brought to bear on these sorts of analyses. That is the lesson learned in bright red neon.
Sally, if you were to just outline in general the chart, you said a minute ago, like, they were just bioinformaticists, but you were the guys who picked them. Again, stepping back, if you were picking the group and giving them a charge and saying, go after anything you want, or I don't know, whatever it is, how would you, and not necessarily for Duke, but just for others, mm-hmm. If the data is complicated and it's different expertise, how do you appropriately charge a committee like this to do a fair job?
This is something that we're grappling with internally as well when we think about the quality framework. It seems to me that you need a really diverse group of individuals looking at it. You need someone with the quantitative expertise. You need somebody with the clinical expertise. You need somebody with the, if you will, the basic science or biological expertise. And in retrospect, I'd say another error is that if there really is significant questions about an area of work, you, in a way, need central involvement in, if you will, overseeing the data transfer, making sure that the implementation of a review process is exactly as it's configured. I mean, the IRB was, I think, an appropriate body in a lot of ways, but as Dr. Follett has indicated, they're really charged with protecting human safety. They're not charged, exactly, they're not charged with the science. Yeah. So I think these sort of things require both a safety review and a real true scientific review, and making sure that the expertise is brought to bear, is available for both of those things is critical.
Is it worth explicitly encouraging the people on the committee to perhaps, I'm just, you know, guessing, talk with you about the charge, or say, talk with the NCI if they've had input into this, or Bagley. Right. You don't have to believe any of these people, but just to learn what the depth and the nature of the right. problem is, and then you guys judge.
Right.
But would that be an appropriate kind of thing that might help?
Absolutely. I think it certainly should be encouraged that anyone who raises issues can have direct input into the process. So, as I said, it was our understanding that the reviewers could speak to whomever they wanted. But in retrospect, as you say, had they been explicitly sent to Dr. McShane or sent to Dr. Baggerly and said, look, use this as a dimension to inform your analysis, obviously there would have been a different outcome there. And I think that that's one way going forward to think about that, which is thinking about the universe of people that might have information that could be brought to bear and actually setting it up so that there's input from multiple avenues into the process. Absolutely.
Well, I don't think we want to lose sight of the fact that the primary responsibility here is with the people who are doing the research and the people around them. And in this effort, the reason there's so much judgment, in my view, needed is that you don't want to paralyze your whole institution with comments left and right. So
you absolutely don't. And I totally agree with you that PI has the main responsibility. What makes this different is that by the time it got to the university, there had been really serious challenges. And you guys are stuck with the we don't do it all the time, but we've really got to do it. And in those rare instances, and thankfully they're rare when it happens, how do you do the right kind of job?
And we thought we were going to get answers to the questions we were posing, but as you said, it the dimensions of it were beyond.
But you did get the answer that might have been what was
desired by the players, which was, can you get somebody to say that we should resume the trials?
But, you know, it's that may have been desired by the players, but as an institution, we really wanted to know. We wanted an external evaluation that would say yay or nay. So regardless of what the players wanted, we really did want an unbiased review.
Yeah.
In the absence of trials, I'm not sure the review would have taken place. It took place because of the patient safety trigger.
Right.
It took place under the IRB because of the patient safety trigger. And this was the document that was sent to this committee, but the charge, the second charge, which was the important one, was do the methods as originally developed and as applied in the context of these trials remain valid.
But was there other background and so forth? I mean, you didn't send what two sentences and say, do this. There was an invitation letter and a cover letter, and here's
Absolutely.
The background. And
these were scientists that were familiar with the debate, had followed the debate, were aware of the back and forth, and we believed were well-positioned to help us understand and be experts. Perhaps in the end, their charge was too limited to identify these things. And, you know, Dr. Fleming and the rest of you brought up terrific points that could have added to the review, but when we received back a relatively affirmative answer to number two, administratively, we first spoke with the NCI, digested the review, and then told the other parties that with this in hand, you could consider restarting the trials if all the various bodies agreed, and that's how we proceeded.
Bill, can you throw any light on any aspect of this?
The light I can cast on it is from the role that I played as the third person who presented to the external reviewers the bulk of evidence that was provided to them. You can guide me as to whether you know what level of detail is informative and helpful for the group. But you know, I would say that there was an attempt on my part to at least comprehensively provide information pertaining to that charge of confirming that the method supplied was appropriate in the clinical trial based on the work that I had done.
And, can I interrupt for 30 seconds and just want to add one dimension to this, which is it never would have occurred to us, based on how those of us who collaborate work, that Bill didn't see that communication from Dr. Baggerly. So Bill was not aware of it at the time.
That is true. I did not.
And the Baggerly
Annals of Applied Statistics article was published by this time, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And I was familiar. I had read the Annals of Applied Statistics paper, and I was aware of the particular data issues that were being raised by Dr. Baggerly there. And it is true that that Anil Patti and Joe Nevins drafted, as part of the information that was provided to the external reviewers, a point-by-point answer to the roughly, I can't remember, six or seven items of data integrity that were raised in the Annals of Applied Statistics. So I was familiar with that aspect of it. The issues...
So you weren't involved in that draft?
I commented on it, but I was not, because I was not a member of the research team that had done the Nature of Medicine.
Right.
I really couldn't speak about the original science that was done. I'll get into more detail about what I provided, which was supportive of this to a degree. But I would also mention that the three items, having now gone back and read the Baggerly letter and supplemental material he's thankfully provided with what he gave to Sally, you know, those represent three new data integrity issues that were being raised. Well, two new. One of them was actually a repeat with regard to the question about the pemetrexed signature being flipped, but two new ones, one of which I was aware of from my own interactions with the group, but one of which I had never known before and really falls under the category of is this data fatally flawed? So, just to quickly, I don't want to take up too much time, but just to enumerate, kind of having been in that room and interacting with the external reviewers, you know, my sense, certainly at the time, was that there was an attempt on everyone's part to provide comprehensive information to the reviewers. There was both, you know, the journals, the original journals in question, and the point by point reply that was drafted. And then that was presented by Anil Patti to the external reviewers in a slides presentation. And then subsequent to that, I gave a presentation that spoke about the informatics system that I had put into place so that these genomic predictors could be applied prospectively. This is something we can get back to throughout today as needed, but, you know, again, it speaks to the efforts taken to lock down the genomic predictors so they would be applied prospectively in a verifiable manner. In addition to that slide material, I had created test instances of what had actually been informatically set up for the clinical trials and ran them live during the interaction to show that the results that informatics system generated were identical to results that were being generated on the trial months earlier for actual patients. We provided the data, the source code, and computing power to run those instances themselves. We provided, and then the final element that was provided is what I had mentioned earlier in terms of a draft manuscript that I was working with Nevins and Patti to submit, in which what was taken was three of the previous validation data sets and to apply the prospective algorithm to those data sets to ensure that there's concordance in what was seen with the prospective algorithm as compared to their original validation, which had already appeared in some of the original manuscripts now retracted. And so that data and source code for applying that prospective algorithm to these historical data sets was provided to the external reviewer. However, while I had, I certainly was the one actively involved in the development of all of the code, the data was, the genomic data was built from a primary source of genomic data. I think the crux of this entire matter is that the clinical data that I used and the clinical data that was provided in this instance were constructed by the laboratories of Anil Patti. So.
And you never had
occasion to go back to try to verify the primary data from the NCI 60 data sets the way Baggerly did.
So I think actually I have done that, and I can speak more to that at any point. So in terms of the signatures developed themselves, I have gone back to the primary sources of the NCI 60 cell line and in terms of the data that was provided by the European investigator, Giorfi, that was underlying the cisplatin and other signatures, and have confirmed the data in retrospect and have gone back to confirm the data provenance of those. It's in the validation data sets where primarily going back and evaluating has demonstrated data corruption issues. And I'm going to slow down and try and remind myself, you know, that I want to say everything to the committee, but I need to bear in mind the misconduct investigation. So I do want to speak as slowly and deliberately through that. But
if we just to talk a little bit more specifics, our understanding, looking through the Duke historical perspective document, was that on June 29, 2010, NCI had specifically directed you to actually dig into the data and ascertain the validity of the data and the omics predictor based on those data. So that our understanding is that you did this in response to that request after June of 2010.
So what I was just describing was the external review process that happened in December of 2009. It is true that subsequent to this, there was the interaction where the NCI was reviewing the R01 grant submission by Anil Patti, and I, along with Sally and other Duke people, went up as part of that, and I gave a very similar presentation in terms of the prospective algorithm and the information systems. And it was subsequent to that meeting that based on the fact that the information provided by Anil Patti did not exactly regenerate the figure, in this case it's figure 2 of the JCO paper, first author David Shi, that I was asked and I accepted the responsibility of trying to go back, find primary data sources for that particular research and reproduce it.
And so, but our understanding is that key step that Sally had mentioned earlier was not realized that it had to be done, and it wasn't given as a charge, part of the responsibility for the IRB external review group, that specifically NCI had directed that you carry out that key step that you then did after June 29, 2010.
Yeah, I began to take that, yes.
So then this, I guess what follows from that then is 9 months earlier, on October 09, the IRB statistical group were being charged, and by that time, in that time frame, you yourself hadn't done that exercise. You yourself hadn't gone back and validated against the source data.
Correct.
And maybe the rest of the questions relating to that we can discuss as we get into the quantitative part this afternoon.
You know, it's interesting. I'll make one comment with regard to this, which was that issue of reproduction of the exact figures was not in our head until that cancer letter came out, which essentially questioned the integrity of the review process. And our response immediately was to call Lisa, which she probably remembers, and say, look, enough is enough. We need to sit down face-to-face and figure out what the basis of the scientific discrepancy is. And when we went up in June, then it became crystal clear that that was what the issue was. And that had been fairly murky, or we hadn't perceived it. It was a communication issue. And as soon as that became clear, that's when Bill went back and tried to start really...
So from point of view
of the community, which basically there's a taint over the whole omics world from this situation. It took 4 years to get to that point. So you mentioned missed signals many times today. There are other situations where people do stupid or illegal things, and sometimes they get confronted, and it all ends right there. It's not like it never happens. And it's awkward. I'm trying to understand this whole conversation, the central role of the IRB. You haven't spoken, I don't think, John, in this segment. So the question is, first, did you feel it was appropriate for the IRB to be in charge of this kind of investigation? Did you think it was appropriate? Do you think now as a supervisor of the IRB, it's appropriate to more or less have turned the whole thing over to Dr. Nevins? That's to say, to decide what data would be given to the external reviewers, decide how to present it, and persuade them that what he did in all cases was correct or close enough to correct to be sufficient. That whoever decided to suspend the trials had made a mistake, and they should resume. Those are big questions to drop on the IRB or on a, I don't know how well prepared, set of outsiders, two people. What's your retrospective on this, at least?
I was somewhat peripheral to the process because I was out of the country when this whole thing began. While I kept my finger on the pulse during the time, I wasn't attending meetings, I wasn't participating in discussions that Sally's described, things like that. So I can't comment firsthand on any of that. To the point of turning things over to Nevins, I don't think that was done. I do understand the point at which you might conclude that, but the actions by John to share the information with them was done in good faith, done as a courtesy rather than done as a abrogation of responsibility. The resumption of the trials was a complex process that had to do, number one, with information back from FDA, a response to that information in keeping with our prior experience with the FEBO trial, lack of information back, lack of response from the FDA to what we thought as looking at what the response back to them in December was, which was a serious attempt to respond and clarify and modify the trial to accommodate the concerns that FDA had, and hearing nothing. We felt it was appropriate to go ahead and proceed. In retrospect, we now know that the obligation is on us to pick up the phone and call. And that didn't happen. Email, yes, but not call. And we would do things differently.
No, it's unfortunate, and of course these kinds of processes take an inordinate toll in anxiety and stress, and even when people are absolved, it has a huge toll. We aren't set up to do this kind of thing.
No, the only good thing is that at least it's also spawned a whole generation of new processes that, you know, yeah. We wouldn't want it to get there that way, absolutely, but at least there's some upside.
I mean, we certainly have the benefit of hindsight. We can now step back and look and understand a lot of things more clearly than were understood at the time and wonder why things weren't done based on what we understand today. And so I get the fact that some of these things that we think should have been made available weren't. Part of this that I struggle the most with, though, is when the vice dean does the right thing and turns over information to the IRB to be passed on to this review committee, that it was made possible for the people that were being investigated to be the ones who got access to that information and to convince the IRB not to pass it on, when the default position would have been to carry out the vice dean's request and pass that information on.
We all agree with that. I think the part that we still may not be conveying adequately is it's sort of like there is a fork in the road, scientific dispute over integrity. And I think what may make it even more confusing than before is that it's raised as a patient safety issue. But the patient safety issue in what was informing that whole series of decisions, and Sally, or Mike could comment on this, was felt more if you had bad conclusions on a predictor, then you wouldn't want to be doing a clinical trial from it, not there was a fundamental integrity issue with the data. And so it was all going down the road of, was the science informing the clinical trials adequately, not was there a fatal flaw in the integrity of the science. Yeah, and that led to a whole series of decisions that would be different.
Rob, I'd ask you to consider the importance of integrity. I actually think it's not very relevant to the work of this committee. It's interesting and it's important for its own reason. But I think if this had just been, you know, sloppiness or Mother Nature is really, really difficult, the reality is there were very strong claims made in the New England Journal and Nature Medicine, and there were various companies investing millions of dollars and people reorienting their labs. This is sort of the basic bread and butter of the high visibility, the salient science that Gil was mentioning. So that was why it was important. And I think I'd ask if you, would it have less importance if data integrity was not an issue? Isn't sort of the goal of all this to figure out, does Mother Nature work this way? And if it's important to know the answer, then can we have an adjudicator? How do we figure this out? Because the journals didn't help. And you guys are stuck as the university when it comes down to it, if it's important enough to look at. And isn't that sort of, I mean, I'm not saying that data integrity is unimportant, but isn't it real important anyway?
Let's contrast that with what happens in my clinical trials world. If someone raised a question like this, we would have a source code that had been done by two different programmers and matched up. And you go back to the fundamental
source. And you could figure it out.
So to me, that's such a fundamental...
And that's basically, you're just saying that happens all the time.
Let me just add, you know, Dr. Fleming, you said, you know, that when you invoked Dr. Nevin's, and you said the person being investigated, that actually wasn't our format at the time. It was the science that needed to be critically examined as the basis for these trials. No one was being investigated. And in the absence of standard online formats for this data, it was our natural reaction to say we had to go to the Nevins lab to have them provide, with Dr. Berry and others, provide the data to the outside reviewers. I do think, though, that that's a lesson moving forward, recognizing we talked this morning a lot about conflict of interest, and we take in three steps back and recognize that even without outside companies or IP, these investigators were heavily invested in their work, and recognizing that as a motivation to the data that they might or might not provide, probably better to think in terms of the person being investigated rather than just clarifying.
So I concur that I would state it as you did. There's an investigation of the science that was led by Nevins and Potty that this committee was pursuing. But the essence of my statements are still the same with that.
I agree. And in fact, I would say if we had taken that stance, the person being investigated, I think we would have proceeded a little bit differently and maybe had a deeper review, not solely based on the data provided by them.
Well, I would say also if you view this really through the prism of scientific review at the time, it's like if you send a grant to the NIH and there's somebody on the study section that you know hates everything you do, you might request that they be recused. I think this was framed to us as this is extreme bias, and if you really want an unbiased review, just let the data speak for themselves. So again, it was through the prism of a scientific argument, not through the prism of problems with provenance, ways in which the data would underlie a trial, etc.
But if there's a scientific argument between Party A and Party B, and we're setting up an external review process to oversee the integrity of the research by Party B, I don't think I'd allow Party B to have a role in censoring what Party A's insights would be given to that review group.
Right. I agree, but there is, I think, an answer, which Rob alluded to, in terms of thinking how maybe this should be done, which is what we're seeing a couple times now. In retrospect, we should have just said, okay, Dr. Baggerly, come here now. Let's all sit at a table and go through it. And that's what we're doing now in these instances. In other words, I think for an institution, when somebody raises arguments, probably the best thing to do is to invite the critics in and all sit down and try to figure out what the difference is.
In one case, I'm sort of enjoying the outside antagonist said, oh, never mind, it wasn't such a big deal. But in another case, I think they're going to come and we're going to sit down together and go through it. And I think that's actually one of the most important things is if someone is raising a public stink, either go meet them or bring them in so that you're eyeball to eyeball and trying to understand really what they're saying.
There's another way to get third-party impressions. You know, this work was really highly salient and got a lot of citations, a lot of awards. You had other outstanding people on your faculty, including men, two people sitting right here, who could have been asked to play a more significant role in responding to these criticisms. And in fact, it's a commentary on team science as practiced that much of the stuff from Bagley was not, or from the journal editors, was apparently handled by just two individuals without any of their team. Is that a fair characterization? A statement? Is that a factual statement? Did you see the letter, the correspondence exchanges, including ones that were held for many, many months or a year to respond to the journal, that sort of thing? So, I mean, there's an internal process that could have been used, and maybe something other institutions should consider in such cases, that there are other people in, with a stake in the knowledge of criticism raised and the resolution of any disagreements. There's also the possibility of inquiring of other places. I mean, you're one of the leading places, institutions generally, and certainly in cancer research also. It's possible to ask people beyond the fellow who happened to be energetic enough to, you know, and his criticisms were carefully worded, exceedingly carefully worded. They were factual, they were specific, they were basically constructive. So to treat him as a boogeyman and sort of vilify the messenger is awkward. But in the course of this series of deliberation of our committee, we've had occasion to talk with people from other institutions are represented here. Most institutions are aware of this line of work that's published, and quite a few had nothing really kind to say about it. That they had looked at the data and the articles and they thought they really didn't hold together. They made no judgments about intent. They just didn't think it's something they're going to bother to try to use, even though everybody is trying to figure out how to do this kind of thing. And the story from Baggerly was, long ago and is, that he was sitting in his office and two of his clinical investigators came with the article and asked for advice. That's fairly benign, assuming it's true. So there may be other informal ways of gathering some information in these kinds of situations that would actually be helpful and might represent earlier interventions should such situations arise in other settings.